Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Voting is light in an extra day of voting in Egypt's presidential election, and a Somali army chief survives a bomb attack. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. Polls in Egypt's presidential election are open for an extra day today as the government tries to boost voter turnout, and the contest widely expected to bring former army chief Abdel Fattah el-Sisi to power. An unexpectedly low number of voters in the first 2 days prompted the country's election commission to extend voting. However, turnout earlier today was still light. Somalia's army chief has escaped an apparent bomb attack in the capital, Mogadishu. Security officials say the roadside bomb exploded today as an armored convoy carrying General Dahir Adan Elmi was passing by. The army commander told VOA Somali service that he is safe and that none of his bodyguards were wounded in that attack. It took place in Hodan district as a convoy traveled to the defense ministry. Security officials say Libyan warplanes have bombed militia bases in the eastern city of Benghazi. It's part of a campaign by a rogue former general to root out insurgents in that area. Forces loyal to former General Khalifa Haftar launched 2 airstrikes on the compound of the February 17th Martyrs Brigade compound west of the city today. No casualties were reported. However, witnesses say there was structural damage. U.S. President Barack Obama says that American isolationism is not an option, but not every problem has a military solution. Mr. Obama used his commencement address today at the U.S. Military Academy to present his foreign policy vision for his final years in office. He stressed that the United States should never ask permission to protect its people or its homeland, but when issues of global concern are at stake that do not pose a direct threat to the United States, then the threshold for military action must be higher.
In such circumstances, we should not go it alone. Instead, we must mobilize allies and partners to take collective action. We have to broaden our tools to include diplomacy and development, sanctions and isolation, appeals to international law, and if just, necessary, and effective, multilateral military action. In such circumstances, we have to work with others because collective action in these circumstances is more likely to succeed.
Mr. Obama went on to propose a $5 billion fund to help countries fight terrorism and to expand funding for Defense Department intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, special operations, as well as other activities. Less than a week after the country's military carried out a coup, Thailand's government announced plans to allow it to more quickly censor content on the internet. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports.
Two of Thailand's state-owned telecommunications companies are to oversee a new internet gateway that gives authorities more control over censoring material online. Thailand already blocks some online content that authorities deem to be offensive, but the new system would give authorities even more control. The Ministry of Information and Communication Technologies says some stricter measures have already been implemented for the internet as well as social media networks. On orders of the military junta, 219 websites have been blocked as threats to national security. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
China has announced a month-long crackdown on those who spread illegal and harmful information on the country's popular instant messaging services. The State Internet Information Office said today that the campaign will target those with public accounts on services such as WeChat, which has over 800 million users. The statement said the campaign will focus on those spreading rumors and information related to violence, terrorism, and pornography, as well as those using instant messaging for fraud. Renowned American poet, author, and rights activist Maya Angelou has died at the age of 86. The author of the celebrated 1969 autobiography, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, died in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. She was born in St. Louis, Missouri, and spent much of her childhood in Arkansas. Angelou's literary career began after a writer heard her childhood stories. This is Frances Alonso, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Yiswuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Many of the reasons to lapse into a crisis are there right now, especially in the center part of southern Somalia. And the second part of the problem is that we have a major reduction in funding for all sectors, health, nutrition, water and sanitation, education, child protection, and many more.
That's UNICEF's Peter Haley warning that a funding shortage threatens the health of hundreds of thousands of children in Somalia. Also in the news, polls in Egypt's presidential election are open for an extra day today as the government tries to boost voter turnout. And in Malawi, the vote count of the presidential election may not be announced until all court challenges surrounding the election have been resolved. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, polls in Egypt's presidential election are open for an extra day today as the government tries to boost voter turnout in the contest widely expected to bring former army chief Abdel Fattah el-Sisi to power. An unexpectedly low number of voters in the first 2 days prompted the country's election commission to extend voting, but turnout early today was still light. A high turnout is seen as key to legitimizing Sisi's long-assumed win in a process that began when he led the army's ouster of former President Mohamed Morsi last July. Mr. Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood has urged Egyptians to boycott the vote and said in a statement yesterday that Sisi and his allies will not be able to legitimize their actions with more fraud and tricks. Leftist politician Hamdin Sabahi is the only other candidate on the ballot. Official results are expected next week. In Malawi, the vote count of the presidential election may not be announced until all court challenges surrounding the election have been resolved. AFP quotes the anonymous official, as saying, the unofficial count shows that Peter Mutharika of the Democratic Progressive Party is in the lead with 36% of the vote. Lazarus Chakwera of the Malawi Congress Party is in second place with 28%. And incumbent Joyce Banda is in third place with 20% of the vote count. No comment on the claim from the Electoral Commission, however. Commission lawyers reportedly are studying the various lawsuits filed over the election. Ms. Banda and opposition parties have gone to court charging there were irregularities in the election. Somalia's army chief has escaped an apparent bomb attack in the capital Mogadishu. Security officials say the roadside bomb exploded today as an armored convoy carrying General Dahir Adan Elmi was passing by. The army commander told VOA that he is safe and that none of his bodyguards were wounded in the attack, which took place in the Hodan district as the convoy traveled to the defense ministry. Police conducted a security operation after the blast and arrested nearly 30 people. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. And the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, warns that without immediate action from donors, health services for 3 million Somali women and children could end soon. The agency says it's received only about 15 million of its $140 million appeal made earlier this year. Peter Haley is chief of nutrition for UNICEF Somalia. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kepua about the current condition of children in the country and why they may be at risk.
We're in much better situation than we were during and just after the famine. We've had several good seasons of rainfall and harvests and grazing for the animals in general across the country. But in each of those seasons, there's been places in the country that had rain failures or had been affected by other issues such as conflict or access problems. and prices have been rising in many places in the markets. Although on the face of it, we could say that the situation has improved considerably in Somalia, you still have a population who are deeply vulnerable.
Many organizations are saying that Somalia is at risk of relapsing into a major humanitarian crisis once again. Would you agree?
There's two issues. One, many of the reasons to lapse into a crisis are there right now, especially in the center part of southern Somalia. And the second part of the problem is that we have a major reduction in funding for all sectors, health, nutrition, water and sanitation, education, child protection, and many more. So when we say risk, we mean that when we look out there at what could cause a major humanitarian crisis, many of the factors are there. And then what can we do to mitigate those risk factors? We can do much less than we usually do because we have much less funding.
Now, UNICEF, of course, is calling for full funding for its health operations. Can you give me an idea of exactly what type of services you provide and what services might end if you don't get your emergency funding?
The health program works on supporting the health facilities in providing all basic health services to the population, particularly in the central and southern part of Somalia. Those services range from the free vaccinations for simple diseases like measles, polio, and other diseases that are prevented by vaccination, through to treatment of diarrhea, treatment of pneumonia, and treatment of malaria and other diseases such as those, where children are extremely high risk of dying without that treatment. UNICEF supports NGOs and government across the whole of Somalia. With the current reduction in funding, very soon we're going to have to start closing some of the services in some of the most vulnerable places of Somalia. We expect that that would probably affect around 620,000 children under five just on the immunizations alone. And then 280,000 pregnant women would no longer have services for antenatal checkups. And around 720,000 women of childbearing age would not be able to get their vaccinations or any of the type of support that they would need.
Some have criticized UN agencies for making what they call dire predictions about what might happen if they don't get the funding, and that the agencies do that to try to spur donors on. How would you respond to that criticism?
You know, in Somalia, we've been through the famine, and one of the main criticisms for what happened just before the famine is that we waited too long to start talking about the issues we were facing. So the humanitarian community, including the donors, are all very sensitive to whether we should start talking earlier or whether we should wait until we have some surer signs of a crisis happening. So we always have a dilemma. Shall we start crying now, or should we wait until we've got even more malnourished children or even more evidence that we're heading into a problem? And I think that overall, the NGOs, the UN agencies have all taken the decision to start speaking a bit earlier and start highlighting where our particular problems are.
How much money does UNICEF need, and when do you need it?
Our top priority is the health program, and it's around 12.6 million is needed immediately. Basically, we will need to start closing programs in the coming days and weeks and months as the funding runs out. The other programs, at the moment, we're funded around 10%. We requested at the beginning of the year 140 million, and so far we have 10% of that, about $15 million available. So you can see that it's very, very much below what we expected to be able to do this year.
Besides the funding issue, are there any other major concerns that you have regarding Somalia?
We have delayed rains, which are affecting parts of Somalia. And in those areas, the population are very vulnerable and will be descending into a very high crisis situation. The second area where we really are worried right at this moment are the several towns which have recently come under the control of Amisom and the government, but they're surrounded by the Shabab. And we're not able to get access by road to those towns, and the people themselves are not able to replenish their stocks through the markets, as no supplies are getting in whatsoever. So our priority is to try and establish a air bridge to support those populations. As you can imagine, if this goes on for many days or weeks more, then the markets will be empty, the people's food stocks will have gone, and the medical supplies will have finished. And we can be looking at some pretty drastic situations in those towns.
Peter Haley is Chief of Nutrition for UNICEF Somalia. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kepua. The UN Security Council voted unanimously yesterday to refocus the UN peacekeeping mission in South Sudan to concentrate primarily on protecting civilians from intercommunal violence. At the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir says the Council has also warned those obstructing peace and reconciliation that they could face international sanctions.
UNMISS, as the mission is known, was created in 2011 to help the world's newest country achieve peace and support longer-term development. But with the outbreak of violence last December, the mission has had to turn all of its attention to protecting civilians. Now the mission officially will move away from peace-building activities to protecting civilians, aiding the delivery of humanitarian assistance, monitoring human rights, and preventing renewed violence. UN Peacekeeping Chief Hervé Letsous told VOA the new mandate formalizes activities that the peacekeepers have been trying to carry out since the crisis erupted.
We've been doing that since early this year, and so it's confirmation that these are the priorities, pending such time as there will be a political settlement. And then, of course, we'll have to think on the basis of that settlement what will be the longer-term tasks that will need to be redefined.
In December, the UN Security Council increased UNMISS troop strength from about 7,000 to more than 12,000. Not all have arrived yet. The surge will include about 2,500 peacekeepers who will protect ceasefire monitors in South Sudan. The resolution adopted Tuesday expresses support for ceasefire agreements signed in January and earlier this month, and calls for their immediate and full implementation. The Security Council also vowed to consider all appropriate measures against parties who undermine peace and security, a reference to the possible imposition of sanctions. South Sudan's Ambassador Francis Madang Dang told the Council his government is disappointed that UN assistance for strengthening government capacities is no longer a part of the mandate, and hopes it will be included when the mandate comes up for an extension in November.
The objective of capacity building is to help create a state that is capable, responsible, and responsive, not a state that is oppressive. Failure to help build a functioning state could lead to serious problems which the United Nations and the international community might be later called upon to help address.
The situation in South Sudan remains tense, with sporadic violations to the ceasefire between forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and his former vice president, Riek Machar. The United Nations says the violence has displaced more than 1.3 million people. Many have fled to neighboring countries, and about 80,000 are sheltering at UN bases across South Sudan that are not equipped to handle such large numbers of people. Now that the rainy season has begun, the UN's Department of Humanitarian Affairs says it has recorded nearly 600 cases of the waterborne disease cholera in the capital, Juba. 22 people have died. A vaccination program is underway. At a donors conference in Oslo, Norway last week, donors pledged more than $600 million out of the nearly $2 billion needed to fund the humanitarian response through the end of this year. The UN warns that 4 million people face severe food insecurity because of the fighting and their inability to plant for the next harvest. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
A former Nigerian defense minister says time is running out for the government to tackle growing violence in the northeastern part of the country, including the kidnapping of hundreds of schoolgirls and recent attacks on villages. Rabiu Kwankwaso served in the administration of former President Olusegun Obasanjo. He is currently Kano State Governor and is a leading figure in the opposition All Progressives Congress Party. He left the ruling People Democratic Party last year and is considered a potential presidential candidate. Kwankwaso told AFP that President Goodluck Jonathan failed to heed advice to pay more attention to the problems of poverty, unemployment, and illiteracy. He says Nigeria is now reaping the consequences of that failure. You are listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Twenty past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Polls in Egypt's presidential election are open for an extra day today as the government tries to boost voter turnout. In Malawi, the vote count of the presidential election may not be announced until all court challenges surrounding the election have been resolved. And Somalia's army chief has escaped an apparent bomb attack in the capital, Mogadishu. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. In a majority of African countries, at least 30% of girls are married before age 18, often against their will. Martha Vanderwolf reports from Addis Ababa. The rate has led the African Union to launch a two-year campaign to end child marriage in Africa.
14 million girls below the age of 18 are forced into marriage each year by their parents in developing countries. Most of these countries are in Africa. Zainabu is a 16-year-old girl from Niger. She says that she was taken out of school by her parents to get married, but her husband would beat her if she didn't want him to touch her. She ran away to her parents, but they would also beat her and return her to the husband. She says she eventually ran away to an aunt and wants to go back to school. Girls married at a young age often have mental anguish, suffer health problems due to early pregnancies, and are less likely to get an education. Most of them come from poorly educated families and rural areas where girls cannot oppose the cultural norms of the family and community. The African Union campaign to end child marriage is focused on policy action and raising continental awareness. The director of the AU Social Affairs Commission, Olawe Maigun, says member states of the AU should follow and implement legal frameworks that protect children.
The Charter on the Rights of the Child, for example, has clear provisions on harmful practices against the child. And it's clear in the provisions of the Charter, culture or religious or whatever should not be an excuse, and the states must take measures to eliminate them. People use all sorts of excuses to perpetuate what they're doing, but it's not an excuse as far as the Commission is concerned.
Among African countries, child marriage rates are highest in Niger and Chad, with rates above 70%. In Zambia, the rate is 42%. 10 government ministries, including health, education, and legal affairs, are working together to bring that rate down. Zambian Minister of Chiefs and Traditional Affairs, Nkandu Luyo, says traditional chiefs are also trying to change the cultural norm about child marriage in the country.
The reason we felt that the chiefs should be the ones is because it hinges on customary law, and there's also a belief that it is to do with our cultures. When any parent is reported to the chief, first of all, they appear before the chief because there's the traditional court. So they appear before the traditional court and they are charged according to the decision by the traditional court. But they also make sure they go and take that child out of marriage and put her back into school.
The End Child Marriage campaign of the AU is done in cooperation with African governments, UNICEF, and civil society organizations. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Niger and the French state-owned uranium firm Areva signed a new mining deal on Monday after more than 2 years of negotiations. Activists say they are cautiously optimistic about the terms of the new deal, in which Areva has promised to increase royalties to the country and invest in local infrastructure. Jennifer Lazuta has more from our West Africa Bureau in Dakar.
The government of Niger said Monday that it has renegotiated its expired mining contract with the French uranium company Areva. The exact terms of the new contract have not yet been made public. But according to a joint statement by Areva and Niger's government, Areva has agreed to operate under the framework of the country's 2006 mining code, which requires paying an increased share of profits to the government and has fewer tax exemptions. Niger is one of the world's largest producers of uranium and yet remains one of the poorest countries in the world. Activists say it's about time Niger got a fair share of the mining profits. Ali Idrissa is the national coordinator for Publish What You Pay Niger, a network of organizations that campaign for transparency and accountability in the mining sector. He said the signing of the contract is a promising step forward, but not enough. He says for more than 5 months, Areva has continued to refuse to apply the Nigerian mining law. Now they have arrived at a deal, but we don't yet know what exactly is in the contract. He says the government needs to respect the constitution and publish the new terms, and then apply the law to Areva so that Areva's uranium extraction activities actually benefit our citizens. Areva's previous mining contract, which was signed in 2001 and based on Niger's 1993 mining code, expired last year. Under the old terms, the company was exempt from paying export duties on uranium, as well as from all customs duties and value-added taxes on mining materials and equipment. Under the new contract, Niger could see an increase in the rate of mining royalties from 5.5% up to 12%. Publish What You Pay says that a decrease in VAT exemptions could increase tax revenues by between $13.6 million and $20.5 million per year. Areva says it also plans to invest an estimated $160 million in local infrastructure projects. However, the company, which has previously stated that the terms of the 2006 mining code are not profitable, says it will delay the start of production at its newest mine until the new terms become profitable. The delay at the mine, which is expected to double Niger's current uranium output, could mean a significant loss of revenue for the government. Alice Powell, the communications coordinator for Publish What You Pay, said only time will tell how the new deal benefits Niger's people.
I think the key thing is, however, is when the contract itself is published and we can see all the details, we can see the extent of this, and make sure and see what exemptions and concessions have been granted to see how much the government is really getting and the extent to which the mining code is being applied in full.
Powell said that Niger's constitution requires that the contract be made publicly available. Publish What You Pay is calling for it to be published immediately. Jennifer Lazuda for VOA News, Dakar.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Love African music?
Music time in Africa.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900, 2000 and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.